joined by Dr. Gerald Horn, a national treasure, I must say. Dr. Horn, author of more than 30 books, his research on racism in a variety of relations involving labor and politics and civil rights and human rights and international relations and war. It is so good to have Gerald with us and to have his work that we can plow deep into to pick out the lessons, to understand the history of this country, to inform our future. Dr. Horn, it's great to have you with us again.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I have labored over how to begin the program, but I think I'll start this way. I generally turn on what is not even considered right-wing radio, but it is just a very dominant station in New York, iHeartRadio, WOR. And certainly it is of the right, no doubt about it. And it splashed all over my being this morning with its opening on one section was Dudes on Dudes, which is a kind of locker room feature that they have where the essence of a patriarchy is completely and thoroughly on display. And then the next one, which was about as much as I could take for a morning opening, was Are You Ready? The segment is Are You Ready? And they do this daily. And they've done this for months and months and months and months. But now, Are You Ready for Violence? See, they're openly using the word and advocating violence. Are you ready for violence? The borders of every country historically have always been defended by violence. It's what we do. Are you ready? Are you ready to get them? And we need violence to take them out of our midst. And of course, this is referring to the undocumented workers that have come to this country, pushed out by, no doubt, the policies and practices of the U.S. and so on. So are you ready? This is the climate that we are operating in. So off of that, I just want you, with your historic sensitivities and work and research, to help us understand what you think are the roots of the U.S. populace in such large numbers digesting such cruelty and violence, such what, patriarchy, xenophobia, racism, and the like. What is it in this country that permits us to have such shallow and brutal policies against anyone who we can term and make the other, if you will?
Well, first of all, if I happen to be converted into an Israeli patriot, I would be quite upset with my counterparts in North America and the United States, because, as you know, since October 7, 2023, flung across the Atlantic has been this idea, which is obviously accurate, that Israel constitutes a settler colonial state. But what's remarkable is that many of those flinging that accusation, that accurate accusation at Israel, somehow do not recognize that the United States itself is a settler colonial state. And being a settler colonial state, that has presupposed a certain kind of class collaboration between and amongst descendants of the settlers of European descent and the 1%. And of course, you see that reflected in the Trump coalition, not only on January 6, 2021, when they tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power, when you had CEOs flying in on airplanes, declassed elements, military veterans, shopkeepers, workers, etc. And because of this class collaboration, it has led too many in the working class of the United States to be infected by this retrograde ideology. And combine that with the history of the United States, which many of us have been trying to rewrite, speaking not only of my work, such as the Counter-Revolution of 1776, and the work of the late dean of the graduate school at Fordham University, speaking of Tyler Stovall and his book, White Freedom. I'm speaking of Ishmael Reed, still in the land of the livings, the paramount Black intellectual, and his spoof of the Disney come Broadway extravaganza, speaking of Hamilton. And to a greater or lesser degree, many of us have tried to revision the creation myth of the United States. I, of course, have suggested that 1776 was a counter-revolution driven by the desire to override London's attempt to prevent itself from spending more blood and treasure, making war against the indigenous population so that land speculators like George Washington could prevail. And likewise, of course, there was upset in Washington, there was upset by Washington and his comrades with regard to Somerset's case, that is to say, which seemed to suggest that London in 1772 was moving away from slavery to abolition. And certainly London had become heavily dependent upon troops of African descent. And so we see, many of us see, 1776 as a counter-revolution, 1876, when you had the overthrow of Reconstruction, this early attempt, if you like, to bring diversity, equity, and inclusion to these shores, and 2024, in that particular ignoble tradition of counter-revolution. I find it hard to accept this idea that those in the working class who voted for Trump are voting for their interests when we do not see in the Republican Party any movement towards raising the minimum wage, any movement towards unshackling and unleashing the National Labor Relations Board to make it easier to organize unions so that workers themselves can demand better wages and better working conditions. And so I think it's also a sort of denial of the agency of these backwards members of the working class, because, of course, supposedly they are upset with the elites who have plunged the nation into one unwinnable war after another, speaking of Iraq 2003 or Afghanistan, ending ignominiously in 2021, and Libya in 2010, 2011. But I happen to be around for all of these conflicts, and some of those backwards members of the working class were actually supporting those particular wars. And so we should not deny them agency. We should not act as if they are simply pawns on a chessboard. But at the same time, when we do this analysis historically, we also have to recognize what helped to rescue us from previous ravages. And I'm speaking of the international situation. We would not have been rescued from enslavement but for the advent of the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, which ignited a general crisis of the entire slave system, which then, that is to say, the successful revolutionaries aligning with British abolitionists to put enormous pressure on the United States to the point where, in order to avoid defeat by the slave-owning Confederate States of America, they had to issue an Emancipation Proclamation allowing for the recruitment of hundreds of thousands of Black troops, the so-called Sable Arm, which defeated slavery. And likewise, with regard to the retreat of its follow-on spiteful, hateful system, speaking of Jim Crow, we all know that the retreat of Jim Crow has a lot to do with the fact that Washington found it difficult to win hearts and minds in a decolonizing world post-1945, given the stiff challenge from the socialist camp, and given the fact that there was revulsion in the Caribbean and Africa to Jim Crow U.S. apartheid, particularly as students started arriving at U.S. campuses such as Howard University. And so once again, it was the international situation that helped to rescue us. And so as we understandably look with great concern at this counter-revolutionary moment that's unfolding as we speak, we should not lose sight of the fact that there is an international situation that beckons with openings. I'm speaking of the fact that it's apparent that Mr. Trump and his cabal are trying to cut a deal with Russia in order to focus like a laser beam on China, But focusing like a laser beam on China brings its own complications and contradictions, not least the fact that his fair-haired boy, Elon Musk, his whole business enterprise, particularly Tesla, is heavily dependent on the Chinese market. Miriam Adelson, the billionaire casino magnate who supplies funds profusely to both Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu in Israel, likewise is heavily dependent upon casinos in Macau, the possession of the People's Republic of China. And so that's going to create enormous contradictions and complications. Not only that, but of course, all of these corporations that are invested in China, speaking of KFC, Starbucks, Microsoft, Apple, et cetera, either they're going to have to take a haircut or somehow they're going to be pressured with regard to their bottom line by Beijing. And likewise, it seems to me that with Mr. Trump's attempting to break away from NATO, at least that's what he says he's going to do, that opens the door, as the meeting in Budapest, Hungary today of European Union leaders suggests, of Europe possibly trying to, or at least France, I should say more specifically, which has the left wing in the parliament represented, which has a ruling class with pretensions and ambitions all its own, led by Mr. Macron, to try to organize some sort of anti-Trump, anti-US imperialist front. We all know about the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, their successful meeting in Kazan, which over the horizon is going to be challenging the paramountcy of the US dollar. And so I would say in the first instance to the Black Liberation Movement that there should be a realization and recognition that the compromise of 1954, whereby internationalist leaders led by the late great Paul Robeson were tossed overboard in return for anti-Jim Crow concessions, well, that compromise expired a long time ago. It's time to revisit the international situation because it's clear that our enemies gain momentum internationally with regard to all of these military conflicts, which then leads to our tax dollars going to these military conflicts as opposed to education, healthcare, and human needs. And similarly, with regard to the labor movement, it's long past time to engage in an internal struggle against this class collaboration, which has marred the workers' movement at least since the 18th century. That is to say, we saw it manifested when Sean O'Brien of the Teamsters spoke at the GOP convention. We saw it with the abortive longshore strike led by Harold Daggett, he of the $900,000 a year salary, the palatial mansion in New Jersey, the Bentley automobile sitting in his driveway. It's long past time to engage in a struggle against those sorts of elements as well. And so as we understandably try to develop a platform and a program for struggle, we must go into struggle animated by an acute historical understanding that helps us to develop an adequate strategy and tactics.
You know, I just want to dig deep into something that we touched on earlier and then return to the international arena. But we have been taught with generalities, that we have a beautiful history of struggle against abuse and fascism. We have an ancestral legacy of resistance against colonialism within us, and that's what's going to kind of cause us to come together. The working class, immigrants, people of color, again fight with dignity for a democratic institution of government. But I want you to just look at that and help debunk it, because part of what I am most concerned about, and it's really taken root. And I didn't need iHeartRadio to understand that. And that is the issue that this is a country where fascism can happen, has happened. And the historic sellout of Reconstruction, the era of Jim Crow, was indeed fascism. And we've never grappled as a nation with that reality. And when we've tried to teach things like critical race theory and the like, that's why the right became so hysterical, because we were beginning to try to understand the institutional nature of white supremacy and settler colonialism and the like. So to your historic mind and studies and research, is that really at the core of why the populace can, at least a good section of the terribly large section of the population, has been so ready to sell out their own interests because of issues of white supremacy and because we've never really grappled with the issue of fascism here, which is stimulated by xenophobia and white supremacy, settler colonialism, and so on?
Well, the implication of what you're saying, I agree with, which is you just can't parachute into 2024, make an analysis of the forces on the ground, and think you understand what's animating these forces without an acute understanding of history in the past. You know that a couple of years ago, I published a book subtitled Texas Jim Crow and Slavery and the Roots of U.S. Fascism. And one of the points that I put forward, indeed, in the initial pages, is that if you begin to look at the genocide against the indigenous population, somehow that genocide escapes the attention of many of our friends on the left, which I'm sure helps to account as well for the support that genocide in historic Palestine receives from a significant percentage of our population. You'll see that there was a split in the settler population with regard to the indigenous question. That is to say that there were those who wanted to see the indigenous placed on reservations. That was the implication of so-called Indian Territory. Today's Oklahoma was supposedly was going to be granted to the Cherokees, the Choctaws, the Creeks, those we refer to as the Seminoles, et cetera, for as long as the grass shall grow and the river shall flow. And of course, like many promises, that was overturned by the settlers. But there was another faction that was hotly opposed to reservations. They wanted genocide. They wanted liquidation. And it was that particular faction amongst the settlers that wound up prevailing, which is why I'm speaking to you from Texas, where it's difficult to encounter a Comanche who approximately 160 years ago were the lords of this territory. And it's important to recognize that the liquidation option did not altogether come from on high. There was enormous settler working class support for liquidation because they wanted their land so that they could grow cotton and, with a little bit of luck and a lot of pluck, import enslaved Africans illicitly and live the so-called American dream. And of course, that was the implication of the president who Mr. Trump has expressed admiration for him. Speaking of Andrew Jackson, now disgracing the $20 bill. And he was supported by these pro-liquidation forces, which is one of the reasons why he spearheaded so-called Indian removal, the Trail of Tears, causing the expulsion of the Native Americans from the Southeast quadrant of North America, present states of Georgia, for example, heading towards Alabama. And what's interesting about that is that the Cherokees in particular were willing to accommodate themselves to settler colonialism in terms of converting to Christianity, in terms of sedentary agriculture, up to and including enslaving Africans, for example. But they too had to go. And so you had the spectacle during the Andrew Jackson years of Cherokee affluent being ousted from their mansions in Georgia and European migrants fresh off the boat moving into those mansions. And so we recognize that there is a material basis for neo-fascism yesterday, and I dare say today. Now, I will say this, starting approximately 75 years ago, we had the onset of a Red Scare, a bludgeoning of left-wing alternatives to neoliberalism and capitalism. That bludgeoning continued when you had Black left-wing alternatives arising, such as the Black Panther Party in the mid-1960s, the subject of my most recent book, by the way. And it is fair to suggest that with the bludgeoning of the radical left, that those disgruntled by the status quo, by neoliberalism, they felt that the only alternative to the status quo was a sort of right-wing alternative provided by the GOP and Mr. Trump. Now, to me, that's the most charitable reading that one can muster with regard to what transpired on November 5th, 2024.
You know, and we should mention that the book that you refer to was Armed Struggle. Tell me the complete title again, because it's really a must read for anyone interested in the history, Black history, and its role in transformative processes and democratizing and the tactics and strategies of struggle of this country. It's Armed Struggle.
With a question mark. Armed Struggle, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and 70s.
A must read. A must read. You know, one of the things that of all people, Richie Torres, congressman in New York, who describes himself as the most ardent of Zionists, my goodness, who has now become a darling of the right, his interpretation is the debacle that just occurred, which in many ways was not so surprising. We've seen it on the rise for 4 years, and we lived with it for 4 years before that of Donald Trump. It's been there, and it's been the cooperation of particular sections of the plutocracy and the like that have aided and abetted. But Torres says, the debacle of this election is the responsibility of the quote-unquote far left. Your thoughts on the responsibilities and the issues of the left performance and behavior, such as it is, and there's certainly no homogeneous left in this country, would that there were, but your thoughts about the issues of the left in dealing with bourgeois democracy and dealing with the electoral process and in this time particularly?
Well, I've already made, which is that adjusting to intensity regard to collaboration, but remember this U.S. left, the order of mismarried in of a billionaire that act. I think that it's difficult to separate the victory of Mr. Trump in Michigan from the lobbying of the Bulos family and their ilk, those like them, for example. And so I would urge and recommend that Congressman Torres bone up on that sort of news item rather than going on these wild goose chases, which obviously will bring him more campaign donations with regard to bashing the already under siege U.S. left.
And your thoughts on, let's continue on what the Trump administration, in your understanding, portends in terms of the international arena, which you look at with such depth, and where do you think that we go? I mean, there's been this generality that he is a non-interventionist. I've never thought of him as a non-interventionist. I think of him as an opportunist. And an authoritarian, and it concerns me his allegiance to and relationships with the Viktor Orbans and the like from the far right, certainly neo-fascist authoritarians throughout the world. So your thoughts on where the Trump administration, just as you've brought up the issue of the new alliance through his daughter, Tiffany, with the Lebanese, neoconservative or possibly fascist entity.
Well, obviously, there's going to be enormous pressure on the Haitian diaspora in North America, 300,000 of them 300,000 of them enjoy temporary protective status, given the defamation of that community during the solitary presidential debate. We can expect that there will be an attempted mass deportation. Already the investor class has bid up the stocks, the prices and valuations of stocks in the prison industrial complex, because they're envisioning mass detentions beginning in 2025. Certainly, it's incumbent upon all of us to rally to the defense of that beleaguered community. I would also say that internationally, in addition to Haiti, there's going to be enormous pressure on the incoming Sheinbaum administration in Mexico City, given the apparent impending deportation of many nationals of Mexican ancestry. Obviously, this is going to inflict hammer blows on the U.S. economy in terms of the food we eat from the fields of California to construction sites from the Atlantic to the Pacific. But as you know, Mr. Trump's calling card, allegedly, supposedly, has been his allergy to getting involved in foreign wars. Now, of course, some of that has been accidental. Certainly, the assassination of Qassem Soleimani, the Iranian leader, could have been the cause of a war. And certainly, with regard to Mr. Trump's closeness to Mr. Netanyahu, which admittedly has had hiccups, that could lead once again to a targeting and focus on Iran, which could precipitate easily World War III. But assuming that Mr. Trump reels back on that particular diabolical program, what we can expect generally, I think, if Mr. Trump carries forth on his pledge not to get involved further in foreign wars, that there will be more attempts at dirty tricks. Watch the budget of the intelligence agencies led by the CIA. Watch for the eruption of so-called color revolutions. Watch for a continued attempted destabilization of socialist Cuba, and a continuation, I'm afraid to say, of the Biden administration policy towards Cuba, which in many ways was a reversal from the Obama administration policy towards Cuba. But once again, there are contradictions in Mr. Trump's international program that opens up opportunities for progressive thinking forces. For example, it's apparent that he's tried to ingest the lesson of the Cold War. 50 odd years ago, the Nixon-Kissinger overture to China, turning it against the Soviet Union, led to the demise of the Soviet Union by 1991. But of course, it also led to massive foreign direct investment in China, which has created this juggernaut. And by the way, at the apex of the sailing across the Pacific of entire industrial plants from the United States to China, the U.S. ambassador to China was a labor leader. Leonard Woodcock of United Auto Workers, which once again brings us back to this question of class collaboration. But in any case, Mr. Trump, who overestimates his diplomatic acumen, thinks that he can woo Russia into a kind of reverse Nixon-Kissinger maneuver, woo Russia to tackle China. I don't think that's going to work, as evidenced by the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Russia and China are its closest lips and teeth. Russia is in the catbird seat right now because it also has good relations with New Delhi, relations with India, and not only United States and Canada. They're deteriorating as we speak. And so that opens up opportunities once again for the strategically minded left to try to take advantage of these contradictions in the international situation to our benefit and to the benefit of those constituencies we're sworn to uphold and protect, this Haitian 300,000 strong community in the first instance.
So let's just go back to what you think the takeaway is from this particular election that we just had, and your thoughts on whether or not there is a distinction that is worthy of, at this time in our history, when we do not have an extensive left movement and so on, looking at the nuances between bourgeois democracy and full-on authoritarianism and what I don't think is neo-fascism, I think is actually fascism. I don't know if you would agree with that in the form of the Trump administration and certainly the policies and practices of Project 2025, which people should take deadly seriously. They are whatever ideological sensitivities the Trump administration has, by and large, that will shape the years to come. So your kind of takeaway on, in summation, if you will, of how we look at the issue of how to respond to, again, bourgeois democracy and certainly whether you consider it to be neo-fascism or fascism in the way we responded in the progressive movement to the electoral process.
Well, it's no secret that there was a split in the U.S. left with regard to the approach to these elections. On the one hand, you had forces, estimable forces, by the way, who felt that there needed to be a strategic vote in their minds for the Democrats, for Vice President Harris. On the other hand, you had forces who are disgusted with the current trajectory of the Democratic Party. And they mounted the independent campaigns, be it the Greens or Claudia De La Cruz or Dr. Cornel West, et cetera. But there was a third school of thought that did not get as much attention, I'm afraid to say, which points to the fact that all of us know, and that in fact unites left, right, and center, and we should always be seeking points of unity as opposed to points of division, that there were only really seven states at play. So-called swing states during this election because of the machinations of the Electoral College, the fact that you can get the most votes and still lose, as Al Gore and Hillary Rodham Clinton can well attest. And so I'm sitting here in the state of Texas. The right wing has a stranglehold on the state, has had for decades. And the question should have been, with regard to this third school of thought, that since we know that after the polls close, a victory will be declared for the right wing in Texas, in Louisiana, in Mississippi, in Alabama, in South Carolina, other states too numerous to mention. Why don't we mount the alternative electoral platforms and programs there? I mean, I was watching the results trickle in from Washington, D.C. I think that the Democrats won Washington, D.C. by 9-1. And I was thinking to myself, well, if they had won 8-2 with 10% going to third party efforts, we'd be in a better position on Thursday than we were on Monday. But once again, it's going to take a while to sort out these various strategic and tactical issues. And certainly I'm confident that we will be able to do so.
And since you mentioned Washington, D.C., you have a new book that is coming out soon. Let's preview it because it goes back to Washington, D.C. and both the struggle there and the resilience and fight back. So tell us a little bit about that so we can prepare for that and get a heads up as we will have you back most certainly to talk more about that book. But give us a bit of a preview.
So it'll be out in about 9 or 10 months. The capital of slavery, Washington, D.C., 1800 to 1865. Washington, D.C., in many ways, was the center of the market in enslaved Africans. That and Alexandria, Virginia, just across the water. But this created enormous contradictions, once again, internationally, because you had foreign legations posted in Washington, D.C., who were repelled by the fact that enslaved Africans were sold within a stone's throw of the Capitol. Not only that, but it created contradictions with abolitionist London during the War of 1812, when thousands of Africans defected to the British side, helped to burn down Washington, D.C., with many of their descendants fleeing on British ships to Trinidad and Tobago, where their descendants continued to reside. After the war, the slave owners put in a claim for their property loss. And as a result, Russia mediated between London and Washington. I think that Russia gave a sweet deal to the slave owners, but they did not agree, helping to generate a good deal of Russophobia that is yet to dissipate. And that accelerated further during the Civil War when Russia sent a massive naval fleet to both San Francisco and Washington to support the Lincoln government, by the way, which enraged the slave owners further, accelerating Russophobia further, which of course then accelerates, by the way, post-1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution. So in any case, this book, like many of my previous books, tries to look at what is ostensibly an epical, profound domestic question, which is slavery, and putting it in a global context as to how that peculiar institution was destroyed, that is to say, by the administrations of Haitian abolitionists and revolutionaries, British abolitionists, Russia, the fact that Brazil would not accept the U.S. Negroes that the Lincoln government wanted to deport to the South American giant, et cetera.
Well, in our final moments for this, because we do want to take people to a rally on our continued work, which is for support for a free, free Palestine. Now, Trump wants us to feel helpless, but we're not helpless. We are not alone. We do have power. Immigrants have power. Workers have power. And we must build it and use it. Your thoughts as an observer and participant, as a theoretician and activist of our work ahead, since we have a very fragmented nascent left movement or left ideology that's out there. Where do we go from here to a fight for the safety and dignity and rights of immigrants and workers and so on?
Well, certainly we have to keep the pressure on with regard to historic Palestine. Like many, I was heartened by these campus demonstrations. Certainly we need to push back aggressively against the crackdown on campus protesters in New York City, particularly the crackdown that's taken place at Columbia University. And tactically, we have to be aware of the fact that there might be contradictions between Trump and Netanyahu that we can take advantage of. Trump has not forgotten that Netanyahu in 2020 November accepted the Biden victory as opposed to signing on to the Stop the Steal so-called movement. That may provide us with a certain kind of tactical advantage. The fact that Mr. Netanyahu has fired Yoav Gallant, his minister of defense, is also reflective of a weakness in Israel, not to mention the fleeing from Israel of the most productive sectors of the economy, not only to Europe, but of course back to Brooklyn as well. And so once again, with regard to the international situation, I'm quite optimistic, in fact, despite this counter-revolutionary process in motion. And I dare say that the impetus and the strong winds blowing in from abroad will help to buoy and propel our domestic movement to our benefit.
Dr. Gerald Horn, indeed, you are a national treasure. We thank you for your dedication to we the people, to educate, agitate, and organize us for a far better world is indeed possible. Thank you for helping to make that so.
Thank you for inviting me.
And again,
we state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people.